Hello and welcome to another episode of Romaniacs, the podcast for people who want to have their Black Forest gâteau and their tart tatin, their pastestinata and their tiramisu, and eat it by staying in the European Union. I'm Peter Collins, and this week we'll be talking about the leaked government plan to keep low-skilled Europeans out of Britain, pretty much everyone out of Britain after Brexit, assuming anyone still wants to come here by then. The EU withdrawal bill and Downing Street's attempts to whip pro-Remain Conservative backbenchers into line. Michel Barnier and David Davis, the love that dare not speak its name. Well, maybe. The shadow that Brexit is casting across the NHS. And last but not least, what Brexit means for Britain's tech industries, for which we have a special guest. Oliver Smith is senior reporter at The Memo, a daily online newspaper which says it's for people curious about the future. I guess that excludes quite a lot of pro-Brexit people who seem to be more curious about a rose-tinted version of the past. But anyway, welcome to the show, Oliver. Now, is it fair to assume that most people in digital and IT-related businesses, the sort of businesses that you write about, are pro-Remainers, or is that just a stereotype?
I think that's totally fair to say. And actually, we saw before the referendum, there was a survey. It found that 87% of the London tech community were pro-Remain. I believe that figure has stayed just as high since.
So you've come up with a solution to all of our problems. We have a second referendum and only tech people can vote.
I'm sure they'd love that.
Indeed. Well, we'll be talking more to Oliver later in the show. Now let's introduce the other members of the panel. First of all, Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk and this podcast's answer to Oscar the Grouch from Sesame Street. Ian, which politicians have been making you grouchy this week, apart from all of them?
Yeah, I mean, which ones have been not making me grouchy would probably be a better question. I mean, it's been another really shabby, terrible week of watching MPs behave in a deeply mediocre way at best. So, you know, take your pick.
Indeed. And also with us, Roz Taylor, who is editor of the LSE Brexit blog. We'll be talking about one of her latest articles at the moment. Roz, which Sesame Street character do you identify with?
Oh, this was a tough one, actually. I couldn't decide, so I asked my husband, and he said, Oscar the Grouch. Yeah, cheers. Because obviously we live in a trash can. I appreciate that. No, so I had to think again, and I thought, well, you know, probably Kermit, because, you know, trying to get a bunch of crazies to actually get the job done. That's not my job description. That's just kind of watching the current state of government in the UK.
Well, I'm the Cookie Monster, I think. When I watched Sesame Street as a child, the message I drew from it was eat as many biscuits as you can as quickly as possible. I'm not sure that's what they intended, but it's the message I took. So anyway, we'll do our usual roundup of the week's Brexit news in a moment. But first, back to Roz for a quick word on how to become a regular Romaniac.
If you've got fed up of all those videos of cats performing hilarious tricks, you'll be delighted to know that YouTube now has a Romaniacs channel on which you can hear the most recent episodes of the podcast. It's simple, really. You just go to YouTube and search for Romaniacs. That's Remain and EX, and not Re and Maniacs, which is what I generally search for. And please subscribe, too, because the more subscribers we get, the more favours we'll have bestowed upon us by the almighty and omnipotent YouTube algorithm. Apple users, please do subscribe via the iPhone Podcasts app or iTunes and leave us a nice review and star rating while you're there. It all helps us to reach more people and get the word out. If you go to our website, romaniacs.com, you can also find links to follow us on Spotify, Pocket Casts, Stitcher, Overcast and Audio Boom, if that's what tickles your fancy. And there are links to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. That's all at romaniacs.com.
And we're already getting comments from viewers of our new YouTube channel. A user calling himself London Boy commented, fuck Spain, we'll have a war with them. Fuck Scotland as well, we'll always rule them. We don't need anyone, we can be self-sufficient, so fuck the EU. Well, thanks very much for adding so much to the quality of the Brexit debate. A more reasoned comment came from Thomas Menezes. He wants us to answer it as well. He says he voted Leave because he feels the European Union's undemocratic. He's never been given a vote for who will lead the EU or for its manifesto. And in the past, it's forced member states to keep voting until what Brussels regards as the right answer. So he wants us to answer this. Do we believe the EU is democratic? Or if we don't, how much is democracy worth to us that we'd hand over our own democracy? Tough question. Who wants to go first?
I'll have a go on that. I think it's a good question, and it raises some valid points. So there's a couple of things here. First one is, it's not anywhere near as undemocratic as its opponents make out, but it's nowhere near sufficiently democratic in order to be properly sort of supported openly in those terms. You have the European Parliament, which is a really good scrutiny body that's made up by elected MEPs. It's people, they go out, they vote for these people, they scrutinise stuff, exactly like it works here. You have the Council, which is made up either of ministers or made up of the leaders, prime ministers and presidents of various states. So it's represented by the votes of people in those domestic countries. So again, that functions according to the democratic choices that were made in countries. And then you have the Commission. And the Commission is an extraordinary beast, really, because it's a sort of government plus civil service wrapped up into one. Now, it proposes legislation. And it is not entirely clear always where they get the ideas for the proposals. I mean, really, they go around different sort of countries. They listen, what are your concerns? Like, let's say around vaping or something like that. And maybe we could figure that out in sort of legislation. They put it forward. Now, the EU works very well as a scrutiny system for the stuff that they put forward. Very, very well indeed. Those layers of scrutiny with a democratic underpinning, I think, is very effective. In terms of proposing legislation, I understand why there's concern there. But I would counter it in this way, which is that basically, for mutual advancement, this is about countries pooling a certain degree of resources. And they do it in order to, say, can trade more so that they can protect themselves more, let's say, by, you know, having an information system across countries that tells you about terrorist threats. And so you do lose a little bit of sort of control in order for more cooperation across those states. But that is an adult choice that you make and that you have to talk about in those terms. So is it perfect? No. But actually, is it justifiable in terms of the other benefits that you might get from it? And is it scrutinised to a sufficient degree? I would argue probably yes.
OK, on to Roz.
Yeah, I mean, I could be facetious and say it's a hell of a lot more democratic than the House of Lords, but I won't. That's the easy answer I'm not going to make. It is a very, very good question. I think the EU has steadily tried to become more democratic as time has gone up on. It's introduced more systems for to ensure that people have more say. And over the last 40 years since we joined, it has become a more democratic organisation. This is not clear to people because when we vote in European elections for MEPs, we don't actually vote on European issues. People vote and they deliver a verdict on the state of the government at the time. Now, to a certain extent, that is also true for local government, but it is especially true for European-level government. So because we don't treat it as though it's a democracy and it can respond to our desires and what we want, therefore, it's not going to be one, basically, because it works both ways. And it has not been a successful system. I think you can make lots of arguments which touch on issues around nationalism, about whether you can have a truly supranational body that is representative, whether people don't want to be governed at that kind of level, on the level of hundreds of millions of people, although look at America, that seems to work okay, but the EU is very different. Whether people like to know that they have a national government which is accountable to their desires and their needs. But that's a wider issue. When you get it down to the nitty gritty and say how could it be improved, there are actually some things you could do to improve the way MEPs are elected. There's been some very interesting ideas, interesting to me because I'm a kind of sad EU nerd, obviously. But the idea, for example, that you would have pan-EU party lists, so that although your local candidate would be local, they would be representing an EU-wide party. And of course, there are already groupings in the European Parliament which our domestic parties join, but these would be much wider, and it would give a pan-European link, and it would mean that everyone in Europe knew what the major parties in the European Parliament party groupings stood for. And that would give a more direct link. So I really like that idea. But as I say, I'm an EU nerd.
Thank you. How about you, Oliver, our guest? Do you feel the EU is democratic or not?
I feel it is. I feel one of the weaknesses has been in education. I think when I was at university, I remember hearing about these big projects trying to educate people on how the EU works. We talked a bit about, you know, the structures and the confusion there. I think there is confusion. And I think the EU has done not a great job at explaining itself to the 500 million people who are out there. So I think that education question is kind of key, and I think they kind of fell short on that.
Yeah, I agree. My point would be that in Britain, we concentrate an awful lot of power in the hands of a prime minister who we don't directly elect, just like the European Commission. What happens is we vote for MPs and we know who, we have an idea of who is going to be the leader. But that's also true At European Commission level, the Commission, the new Commission president, is chosen, officially chosen by the Parliament, and I believe the practice is now that they look at who has got the support of the biggest group of parties within the European Parliament. It's a very similar system of indirect election. Of course, it's at one remove, but then if we want to do things, we want to cooperate with other countries, I would rather we cooperated with other democratic countries whose government has been voted in by the people of those countries, and I'm prepared to share a bit of sovereignty with the people of Portugal and Spain and Italy and so on in order to achieve things. Of course, the EU isn't perfect. It isn't totally democratic. Neither is the British Parliament. Thomas, in his question, also anticipated some of these points we're going to make and said, well, if you want to reform it, how are you going to reform it? My answer to that is that I don't think British governments, successive British governments over the years, have tried anything like hard enough to build alliances within the EU among other people in EU politics who do also want to reform the EU, make it more efficient, make its policies better, make it more democratic. We should have been trying years ago, and it would be nice if somehow we could get back to being in the EU and trying again to reform it. You can only do it by building alliances when you've only got one vote yourself. So, Thomas, hope that's told you something about our opinions. It might not have changed your opinions, but at least if we understand each other's opinions better, that's some sort of progress. Let's go on to our first news item now. On Tuesday night, the government's plans to curb the migration of low-skilled Europeans and pretty much all Europeans to Britain after Brexit were leaked to the newspapers, to The Guardian first. The document, apparently compiled in the last few weeks, stamped with official sensitive across every page in great big letters to make us read it, of course, says that lower-skilled EU migrants will only be able to stay for up to 2 years. Those in high-skilled occupations will get 3 to 5 years, but then probably they will be out. The right for Europeans to settle in Britain for the long term will essentially be phased out, and it'll also become a lot harder to bring in family members. There may be a hard numerical cap on the number of low-skilled migrants, or a minimum salary requirement, or some other way of limiting the numbers. So, Ian and Roz first, what do you think's going on here? Is this a real leak, or is it the government's slipping out a little bit of red meat for the pro-Brexiteers ahead of the party conference?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if they're going to do that, I don't think they're going to send it to The Guardian.
My conspiracy theory, just for the fun of it, is that, you know, they're sitting there thinking, right, we want to get all of the hardline Brexiteers on our side, so let's slip this out to The Guardian, and The Guardian will get outraged about this because it's a liberal paper, and the fact that we are causing outrage for The Guardian will make us popular. That's my theory.
People don't think that way. I think it's a real link. I mean, I think what it shows is the tension, I think, inside government, because there's some weird annotations. I don't know if you got down to the nitty-gritty, but there's a bit where the document refers to the fact that EU nationals currently have to provide a passport number to do something or other, but it doesn't have to be a current passport number. And somebody in brackets put after that, do we have to put this bit in? A slightly petulant way. And I kind of, that almost sounded like Amber Rudd to me, the Home Secretary, think, oh, for goodness sake, do we have to make this point? Just, you know, let's. And I think it was probably leaked by the more pragmatic people in the cabinet or their lackeys. I think it was a sign of the debate going on. For me, that's, I think it still shows, the positive thing is it still shows there's a lot up for grabs. A negative thing shows that it shows is that the hardline Brexiteers look like they might get quite a lot of what they want.
So, well, let's take it from the sort of the pro-Brexit point of view. Maybe we should accept a period of difficulty in recruiting in order to ensure that British people get trained up, employers do more training, they try harder to recruit British people, and that maybe wages go up and that's good for the British economy. Isn't that a good thing?
Well, there's no sign that wages would go up. I mean, there's a section actually that in the paper that talks about the economic effect of EU migration. And it basically just says, oh, it's been really good for the economy. But, you know, probably different in different sectors. And that's about it. And it literally can't even find anything to say that it would be harmful. We hear this thing about the hammering down of the wages. We don't really see it in studies as a couple, but it's incredibly minor, but very, very modest reductions in lower wages, which we're not even sure really take place. So there won't be some great increase in wages in any way in a hard Brexit. Anything that you did get back in that way will be absolutely battered by all the other things you've done by your economy, by leaving the single market and the customs union. This paper, I mean, what's astonishing about it is almost looking at it in terms of the Brexit terms. Because in terms of Brexit terms, it basically means, well, there's no real transition at all, you know, of any sort of close relationship after March 2019. I mean, it's saying there they have this 2-year period. I say, well, we'll maintain kind of freedom of movement, but we'll end the free movement directive and we'll end family reunion. Now, that just means you can't be in the single market of the customs union. That's absolutely written out right there. You can't have a close relationship with it. So we are now back in the land of the cliff edge in March 2019, which is exactly, by the way that David Davis was speaking in the Commons yesterday when he was discussing this. He kept on sort of alluding to the idea that we could finish the deal by March 2019. He kept on accusing Labour, absurdly enough, of betrayal for suggesting it wanted to stay in the single market and the customs union during that period. So the first thing to note from it is really what it means for Brexit. And what it means for Brexit is very hard Brexit. Cliff edge 2019 is now firmly back on the table, and undeniably so.
I thought it was interesting Diane Abbott's very muted initial reaction to say, well, you know, it's not official party, let's just wait, not official line yet, let's just wait and see. I mean, can you see things, you know, if we suddenly have to have an election now and Labour wins it, would things really be that different under a Labour government? Would they just tear this thing up, or would they essentially think we've got to go along with this anti-migration sentiment?
I absolutely believe that if we had a Labour government, they would do things differently. What I don't believe is that as an opposition, they will say things differently. And their response has been completely petrified this morning and last night over this, as it is generally speaking about immigration. They're in such an absolute crisis over it, really. However, when you really look at the stuff that sort of Keir Starmer says or a few others say, they're clearly sort of thinking of, you know, when they say managed migration, it seems to me what they really mean is, you know, oh, on condition of a job offer or something, which is the kind of realistic offer you could make to the Europeans. Say, look, not freedom of movement, but as long as they've got a job offer, they can come over, which isn't really all that different from anyway, the law in the EU. And that would allow a very close relationship. What we're proposing here, which is to take European citizens and just shove them into the standard immigration machine, will get very, very short shrift from the Europeans, and for very good reason, which is that we are not acting like this is a special new relationship in terms of the rhetoric that we've used with them. We're acting like, no, we couldn't give a damn about you. We will treat you absolutely the same as everyone else from every other part of the world. There's no special relationship whatsoever. And therefore, if that's the position that we're going to put forward, then we're going to have to face the consequences of it, which would be very, very severe indeed. They just won't be as severe for us as they will for the European citizens, who are forced to undergo the routine humiliation and bureaucratic horror that the system really entails.
I mean, I think low-skilled EU migrants will simply not bother coming anymore, because even if they found a job in a sector which needed their skills, the bureaucracy involved would be just too much of a pain. And this is one of the unsaid things about the idea of quotas for particular sectors. Take nurses. You know, it's a skilled sector, but it's not a high-earning sector. So you have to earn a reasonable amount of money in order to pay for all the admin to go through these procedures. And it will simply not be affordable for people who are not earning very much to come in and do jobs like that. So we can say, oh, you know, we can do without the strawberry pickers, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we can bring in quotas for nurses. But the nurses won't bother to come if it's too difficult.
And Oliver, presumably there's going to be bureaucracy for high-skilled people, all your people in the tech industries. They'll be told to get out pretty much after 3 to 5 years, and they'll have to fill in all these forms as well, won't they?
Yeah, the immigration policy is one of the real issues for tech. People are terrified about what's going to happen, because we've seen what's happened with the rest of the world. We have entrepreneurial visas, and the systems just don't seem to work very well. As a country, we're not producing the number of skilled computer engineers, computer scientists to supply the workforce that we need. We do need this flow of people who are coming in, who are filling those jobs, because we're not making them ourselves. So unless we either have a very liberal, open immigration policy, which it doesn't sound like that's what this is, there are going to be people who get caught by these policies. And unless our universities start ramping up the courses to start churning out more computer engineers and computer sciences, we're going to have a shortfall.
I mean, why would anyone fucking come, given that this is how we're going to treat them? Like, we talk about the low-skilled. I mean, on low-skilled, you know, there may still at least be some kind of financial imperative for, say, a seasonal fruit picker or something to go do it. When they're talking about the highly skilled, they're talking about, well, we're going to try and limit these positions from 3 to 5 years. Now, their position for permanent residency starts at 5 years. So while they say there may be some route into permanent residency here, in actual fact, it seems as if the entire system will be structured to prevent immigrants from turning into Brits. That is a kind of country which is so profoundly closed, so profoundly unwelcoming to immigrants, that only someone with a very, very low sense of self-esteem would ever wish to live in it. And that, typically is not a highly skilled, high-earning workforce. Not only that, but as soon as you enter the country, they then want to put you on some kind of biometric database, a separate registration system from the rest of the population, which to me seems like an absolute invitation for the very, very worst motivations of government and the very worst, most pernicious kinds of future prejudice that could be enacted by a government. So the question would be, why would they come? Why would anyone want to come to a country which is so unwelcoming that this is the stuff it proposes? And I would suggest that they're not going to want to come, and we will very quickly suffer the economic and the social and the cultural effects of that decision.
It's all a matter of beware of what you wish for, isn't it? So let's move on now to our second news story. Last week, the third round of talks on a Brexit settlement were held in Brussels between negotiators from Britain and the EU. Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, said afterwards that little progress had been made on the three big issues, namely the Brexit bill that Britain would have to pay, the rights of EU citizens in Britain and Brits in Europe, and the Irish border. Barnier accused the British side of wallowing in nostalgia instead of negotiating seriously. David Davis, Britain's Brexit secretary, said Barnier's comments had made him look silly. Liam Fox, Britain's trade secretary, described Barnier's approach as blackmail. Barnier shot back by saying that it's not blackmail, but it is part of his job to educate the UK about the price it has to pay for leaving the club. Davis hit back again by claiming it was in fact the EU side that was frightened of discussing the future seriously. So Ian and Roz, first, did the talks go down as badly as the headlines suggested? You know, are we close to a breakdown?
I was really annoyed about the coverage of this because it was, to be pedantic, a bad translation. Éduquer in French does not necessarily mean educate in English. It's not equivalent. And when he was talking about éduquer, it actually meant he wanted to inform. It wasn't schooling in the way people on Twitter talk about, oh, X has been schooled in this. Ugh. He wants Britons to know what Brexit means for them. And that seems reasonable to me. But of course, because they had a lazy translator, you know, that day, and papers all picked up on that, and BBC, to be honest, did not help. So there was that going on. But in terms of did the talks go as badly as the headline suggested, I think they're probably going pretty badly. I think there's just, we are getting down to the point where there is this huge imbalance where we don't have nearly as much to offer as we have pretended we do. And if we walk out, we are just cutting off our nose to spite our face. And while the EU will be sad about that, it will not be the absolute disaster that it will be for us. And they know that.
But the most incredible thing to me is that they're arguing over actually one of the few bits of leverage that we have, which is money. We have money. We can offer money, you know, in exchange for getting out the securing other things. And somehow, even in this area, which is one of our strengths, we're managing to somehow cock it up. So it is an absolutely extraordinary impasse for them to have reached. Look at the stuff that was put out by CER this week was really, you know, completely bog-standard pragmatic solutions to the thing. And basically going out there and going, okay, fine, look, we need to get on to the second phase of negotiations. We want to be able to use some of our leverage in terms of payments, divorce payments for that. So what will we do? And a good solution would be to wrap it up with some kind of transitional arrangement. You say, look, we'll be 3 years in transition. We're going to pay you 10 billion a year, and we'll do that until the end of transition. That way, because remember, all you've got to do is show evidence of progress on the divorce bill. You don't need to finalise it. You don't need to absolutely sign off on it. Just evidence of progress. That way, we could at least move out of it, still have some leverage over the pensions issue and the assets and liabilities issue, and take that into the second round while preventing ourselves from going over the cliff edge. Now, this is so plainly, obviously reasonable and such a clear, moderate path out of it. And yet it is, of course, and this should surprise no one, considered, you know, radical nonsense by the governing, by David Davis. So it's not a surprise we're not getting anywhere, because he clearly doesn't show any of the intellect or the vision which would get us anywhere close to it.
Just to throw in another conspiracy theory, just for the fun of it, really. There they are, sort of shouting at each other by press conferences, Barnier and Davis. And yet Davis did say that he's known Barnier for 20 years and does like him. Is it possible that behind the closed doors they're saying, look, we have to play up to our respective galleries and make the differences seem bigger than they are in public because we've got our own politics to deal with? But behind closed doors, they're actually edging closer. Is that too much to hope for?
It's not impossible, is it? I mean, I think this is mostly the British spin, is the fact that they get on quite well behind closed doors. You don't hear much of that coming from Brussels. But it's, you know, loads of negotiations look publicly unsalvageable just before a solution emerges. So that is always possible. We're not completely doomed just yet. But I have to say, I think you need to be quite optimistic and quite imaginative to think that things are going particularly well behind closed doors. There's very little reason for us to conclude that.
Yeah, it's possible that after the Conservative Party conference, Theresa May will will offer some money because she has to get through that first. It's possible that will happen. Yeah, I can see that. I think if there's a conspiracy theory to be embraced, it's probably that.
So there was this moment that Verhofstadt came out and just sort of said, well, actually, we're going to get this, you know,
this
important intervention by the
European Parliament. Yep.
I beg your pardon. Yes, we're quite right. Yeah. He said, well, look, we're going to get this big intervention by the British Prime Minister. And I'll talk a little bit further about that later on. It's not really clear what the hell that is. I mean, if it's sort of her taking a more moderate position, I don't know why she would have told him about it because he'd leak it. And if it's her taking a more hard line position, it doesn't really make it. The timing doesn't really make any sense in terms of the Tory party. This came out and I was sat in my office in Parliament. We were just sort of batting it around, thinking like, what on earth could this possibly be, given that she's told him and she's doing it before the Tory party conference? And basically no one really had any idea. So by the end of it, we're like, you know, maybe she's going to call another election.
Well, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah, that deserves a whole podcast in itself. Anyway, let's get on to our third and final news item now. On Thursday, after we recorded this podcast, the House of Commons was due to have the second reading of what was originally going to be called the Great Repeal Bill. Then it was just the Repeal Bill, and now it's the EU Withdrawal Bill. It's like, you know, Sellafield nuclear power thing used to be called Windscale, and they changed the name. Hotmail lost popularity, so they called it Windows Mail, you know, that sort of stuff. Anyway, the second reading's when MPs normally get their first chance to have a proper debate of a bill in detail, and amid reports that some pro-Remain Tory MPs could join with the opposition and try to force through amendments, Theresa May set loose her ferocious attack dog, Deputy Prime Minister Damian Green, who's about as ferocious as Scooby-Doo, actually. But he was warning the rebels that if they support any opposition amendments, they'll be labelled as Jeremy Corbyn supporters. Ooh! So first of all, this sort of approach didn't go down very well with the pro-Remain MPs, did it, Ian?
Well, no, but I mean, I haven't seen much evidence, to be honest, of any kind of Tory resistance to this sort of stuff. I mean, yesterday I went through all, you know, two or three interminable hours of David Davis talking in the Commons, and I didn't see any criticism from the Tory benches at all, apart from Ken Clark. Everybody else was, I mean, even Anna Soubry was attacking Labour rather than him, and there was quite a few of them repeating those lines. I mean, they get given the lines to take, Labour's betrayed the word of the people, blah, 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 they say it, they leave the chamber, that's their job done. I actually didn't, you know, I mean, I thought the Labour comments were marginally improved, but not so improved that you would actually get to the point where you had any faith in the party to scrutinise what was going on. So I haven't seen a big kickback against them saying this. Of course the government were going to say, do this and you'll let in Jeremy Corbyn by the back door, because that's one of the only arguments they've got left, really. But it should go without saying that it is entirely false and that this bill remains the most unprecedented executive power grab, and that no one who had truly was committed to their principles and to their conscience, who had been out there arguing for parliamentary sovereignty during the referendum, could possibly come up there and say that this bill was in any way tolerable. It is the precise opposite of everything that they argued for during that period.
Well, here's an argument to make Conservative backbenchers think twice. Imagine all of those Henry VIII powers in the hands of Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, well, exactly. No, that's exactly so well put. There's a Raphael Bayer piece in The Guardian today, which is this. It's like, when you look at a weapon, when you invent a weapon, think about it in the hands of your enemy. When you give yourself a power, think about it in the hands of those who you would not wish to have it. And Tory MP should damn well look at this thing and think, well, hang on a minute, there's a really good chance you guys are going to be out and there's going to be your worst nightmare, this sort of shambolic communist, is going to be in charge. And you've just basically given ministers the power to do whatever they like without consequence. Now, we can say that there's sunset clauses on this bill of 2 years after Brexit, but the thing is, it doesn't actually say when the Brexit date actually is, so you can basically put that date for any point and allow these powers to just keep on going and keep on going and keep on going. It is, simply put, the biggest executive power grab that we've seen in this country since the Second World War, and the signs to me are right now that the Tories are just going to wave it through.
Yeah, the problem with these Henry VIII powers is that the amount of legislation that can be pushed through without parliamentary scrutiny is so huge. And there is no way that Parliament, let alone journalists, can keep track of it. Basically, you can just keep on pushing through. The amount of scope they have is enormous. In fact, I think there will be so much stuff that the problems will emerge retrospectively and people will say, how could we possibly have let this go through? Oh, we were too busy looking at this other stuff. It's more than a Parliament can deal with. And that's the big problem.
That's what there were solutions to this. You know, at the beginning, it was sort of said, well, look, we're going to create these committees you know, people suggesting this, we can create committees of MPs, maybe you bring in NGOs, you bring in business leaders, you give them advance sight of the main sort of statutory instruments so that you could at least separate it out from the more chaffy bits. You could actually have the proper meaty aspect of it would get an extra element of scrutiny. All of that would have shown a considerable more degree of sort of commitment to transparency and to scrutiny than what the government is prepared to do. And actually, you're right, that the reversal of that is just you shove all of these powers, not even really to ministers, but ultimately it'll be to civil servants. It's not even really giving the power to Downing Street. It actually weirdly gives it to Whitehall to just start doing all this stuff, and they're going to start making lots of mistakes. And what we're going to end up with in March 2019 is an astonishingly messy statute book that doesn't do some of the things that it claims to do and overdoes some of the things that it shouldn't be doing and has basic things like the wrong words in the wrong places. It means we will just have an absolute legislative mess in the wake of this. At the same time, as you know, we've cut ourselves off from our largest market and undergoing all the chaos and uncertainty that that in itself entails.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of work for lawyers, and the more work for lawyers in this instance, the worse, because when people don't know what the law is, that's when your democracy is starting to break down, when you're not sure of the state of the law. And that's why this is so dangerous. Lawyers just proliferating these things are proliferating out of control without people being able to know about them.
Thanks, Ros. Well, that's the news successfully rounded up and sent to the sheep dip, all without the aid of specially trained dogs. Now on to our first big discussion of the week on how Brexit will affect the National Health Service, a subject given obviously more urgency by this leaked immigration policy paper. Ros, you've got a new article on the NHS and Brexit this week on your LSE Brexit blog. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is by an LSE health economist. His name is Joanne Costa-Font. He's looked at the effect Brexit will have in the NHS in the round. Now, we know it's very likely to cause staff shortages, and he's predicted it will drive up wages, not just for doctors, but low-paid staff too. Now, I know we were disagreeing about this a bit, about what the effect on wages will be, but the effect on wages in the public sector, it's going to be quite different from the effect in the private sector. And this is a big deal because the NHS workforce is huge. There are 1.5 million people who work for the NHS. So even when you give them a tiny pay rise, the wage bill just becomes huge. And that's one of the reasons why they're so keen, for example, to keep the public sector pay cap down. So because of that, he says we've basically got a choice. Either we've got to invest heavily in training up new, better paid, hopefully more productive British staff. Remember, Britain is a very unproductive country, and that includes the NHS. They will take a while to qualify, especially doctors. Or we carry on recruiting lots of staff from abroad. And he says Brexit is actually a chance to rethink the kind of NHS that we want, because this is, in effect, a crisis for the organisation. But the kind of NHS we tend to want is generally free at the point of use. And if you're going to pay for that through taxation, that's going to be very, very expensive.
And my big worry about this is that the NHS's pay bill, especially in the light of this immigration policy paper, if immigration policy is as tight after Brexit as it suggests, we'll have a situation in which the NHS's pay bill will go up hugely, but actually the wages of nurses or people who carry the bedpans or whatever will not go up. What will happen is that they'll be having to turn to agency staff. The agencies will soak up a huge margin as they do now. That will all go on the cost of the NHS without really improving healthcare at all. If anybody can get nurses or cleaners or whoever, caterers in from France or Germany or Italy or whatever, and through all this new paperwork, it'll be the agencies. They will charge handsomely for that. They will not probably want to pass on that money to the people doing the work. So I can see a very unpleasant situation where the cost of the NHS goes up, and or in practice, the quality of care goes down enormously because there isn't the budget to cover the higher pay bill. And yet we don't see particularly any recovery in wages.
That is effectively what has already happened in the social care sector, something which is massively underreported and is an absolute scandal, the way that the burden of paying for austerity has overwhelmingly fallen on local authorities. And it is social care that has been cut and has suffered. And it is the people who receive social care who don't have very loud voices who suffer as a result. And you're right, that could very well, that same pattern that we see with agency staff could well spread further into the NHS. I mean, obviously the NHS already uses agency staff, but more so. I think that's a huge risk for the government at the moment.
And yes, we've got, you know, we've had this leak in the past couple of days of, you know, a sort of plans for a very restrictive immigration policy. And yet we've also had a leak of the government's planning, NHS England in particular, planning to recruit a further 5,000 GPs to keep its promises to make sure there are enough GPs, given that a lot of GPs are close to retirement. They're having to trawl, particularly the European Economic Area, to find them. So you've got this, you know, the government's talking about shutting the doors. Meanwhile, it's presumably spending a lot of money, again, probably using agents, recruiting agents and so on, to try and bring in the doctors and so on, because we certainly won't have them trained up in time.
Yeah. The other thing John Costafont mentions is the European Working Time Directive, which is the first time I've actually seen this brought up around Brexit, but it's a very interesting point. Now, you may remember years ago, the European Working Time Directive, there was this huge kerfuffle because it was realised that the European Working Time Directive would stop doctors working excessively long hours. And there was a huge upheaval, uproar about this. But eventually, it was realised that actually it wasn't a great idea to have doctors working a huge amount of hours, and we dealt with that. There are still professions that do. For example, if you're in the emergency services, you do, but not doctors. But leaving the EU means that we can actually opt out of this and not obey it anymore. What he's saying is that that means the NHS will become an even less attractive place to work because they'll be able to basically force you to work as many hours as they like. And that means that fewer, again, people want to come from abroad to work in Britain as doctors.
Doctors are rather like the tech people that Oliver was talking about earlier. They've got choices. If you're qualified as a GP, particularly there must be a fair number of doctors who could go and work in one of the neighbouring countries. If you're already an EU citizen or EU born and you're working here as a GP, you've certainly got options to go back. The idea that, you know, we can sort of set a very restrictive policy and still have medical treatment when it takes how many, 7-10 years to get a doctor trained up. It just seems like a disaster in the making, doesn't it?
Do you know what's going on with drug prices and things like that? I suppose with the sort of fall of value of the pound. I mean, as I thought, lots of the sort of generic drugs that we got were from overseas, and the same with the medical equipment. I don't know. I'd sort of heard worrying signs about that at the start of Brexit and haven't really heard much about it since. I don't really know if we've gone anywhere with that.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure either. It is clear that leaving the single market means that companies trying to get a new drug licensed in Britain will have to do it separately from via the European Medicines Agency. So that will be more bureaucracy, more paperwork. It will very likely take longer.
And there is evidence that, if you're not one of the biggest markets for health, obviously America and Europe and China and Japan are the big markets for buying drugs. If you're a drug company, you've got to get through all this very, very, very complicated licensing process. You're going to target the big markets first. So a new drug comes out and everyone in Europe who suffers from this ailment will have it, and we'll be in the queue waiting for the drug company to put in the application for the license.
Well, we don't even know how that bit's going to work. I mean, you rightly mentioned the European Medicines Agency. I mean, let's say that it is March 2019, we pull out of the EU. Suddenly we don't come under that. We don't really have a body that's able to take on all of that work. And you have the same, exactly the same, by the way, for veterinary medicine. So, you know, there's literally no one to authorise the drug. There's nowhere for that stuff to go. You have to train people up, you have to hire them, you have to come up with systems for how that's going to operate, you have to see them recognised in other states as well. All of that takes an awful lot of time. Now, there's no ideas really floating around for what we're going to do in the meantime if we were to pull out in March 2019. The closest we got was a bunch of Tory MPs who came out and said that they thought the courts should do it. And of course, you know, pharmaceutical trials in a courtroom doesn't seem like a very good idea to anyone, apart from lunatic Tory MPs. So really, we have no ideas there at the moment. It seems like we are going to have at least a few years of just a black hole in terms of regulating drugs and getting them onto the market.
Well, since we're talking about technology-related matters, let's move on to have our detailed chat with our special guest, Oliver Smith of The Memo. Let's start, Oliver. Just tell us a bit more about The Memo. Who's it for? What does it cover?
So The Memo is an online magazine, and we write about business, technology, lifestyle. We try and write in a very human way, so you won't find any buzzwords. We want it to be your daily dose of tech, so you can get up to speed with what's going on, but without having to understand exactly all the intricate details.
And you've been writing in the past few days on the memo about these reports that the government's preparing to pay up to £1 billion a year to stay in Horizon 2020, which is the EU's big science research programme. Mm. I mean, how important is it? How significant is it if the government says we will sign a cheque for £1 billion and keep in this?
This is really important when it comes to academia and research, because Horizon 2020, it's not really about the money, but it's about the network to join up universities across Europe working towards joint research projects. So it's really about that network opportunity. So in fact, the money, if we do pay £1 billion to stay in, we'll probably just get about the same amount of money back. But it's the network that's really priceless. And that's what they're really trying to hold on to here.
Yeah, and you've got other things like the European Investment Fund. Hasn't that backed tech startups in Britain? You know, that it's something that we could do with continuing to have access to.
So the European Investment Fund is all about the money. This is all about the money. About a third of venture capital in the UK comes from Europe. It's EIF money. And this is crucial. All of the tech startups, the UK ones that you know and love, whether it's Zoopla, whether it's Love Film, these have all been supported at some point by European money.
It's amazing that we've not heard this before, really, you know, but apart from regular readers of the memo. This is kind of important that, you know, if we want to have those kind of companies, a European fund to which we belong at the moment is the big thing that's backing them.
Yeah, and it's because it's a little bit removed. It's because when the venture capital funds go out there and say we're raising money to put into new exciting startups, they'll go to Europe and Europe will put in some money. So when the fund makes the investment in whatever the next big thing is, they don't mention the fact that the EU is actually responsible for some of the money, because they, you know, they get all the praise from it. But if this money suddenly disappears overnight, that's a third of the money over the last 5 years that's gone into UK startups that could disappear. And what we're hearing is that the tap has been turned off, because there's, even though we're still part of Europe, these funds are saying we're applying for money, but we're not hearing much back from Europe at the moment. And when journalists like myself ask the EU what's going on with this, they say we need to do more due diligence, which sounds like code word for the taps off, but we can't quite say that yet.
Yeah, in particular fintech. I mean, London is a big centre for fintech. You know, you've got all those sort of startups around kind of Shoreditch area, but the trouble is that, you know, they need to feed to some extent, apart from getting funding from the EIF and so on, on the presence of the big financial institutions which dominate the City of London. And yet they're all having to, you know, take a step out of the door, set up in Frankfurt or Dublin or Paris or whatever. Presumably there's a risk that the fintech scene, the whole sort of, you know, sort of the ecosystem, as they love to call it, starts to migrate too.
I mean, the reason why London is a fintech hub is because of the banks. It's because after 2007, all the bankers thought, oh, this sector looks a bit shaky. Why don't we, you know, step back for a few years? We've got loads of money. And what should we do? We'll start some businesses. And that's where this fintech wave we're in at the moment, that's where it came from. So if the big banks leave, that's capital and that's talent leaving. You know, the UK is home to these fantastic challenger banks, names like Monzo you might have heard of, or Tandem or Starling Bank, fantastic new banks that are eyeing up Europe. They want to take on the world. But they're relying on the fact that we're supposed to be part of Europe, so they can jump across, use passporting, which is lets you jump across into Europe and start being a big bank. Now that we're going, that causes a lot of uncertainty, especially in fintech.
Well, indeed, as these things become big and important, if they're based in Britain, they'll pay their taxes in Britain, even though they are operating on a pan-European basis. Why are we trying to frustrate all of this? I can't understand it.
I mean, there's not many other places in Europe that are as strong in fintech as we are. We are the clear leader. Places like Paris, Berlin, they're trying to say that they are. But the thing about it, a tech hub, is you can't build it. You can't copy it. It's the culmination of hundreds of decisions, the financial crisis, the financial institutions. It's a beautiful sort of creature that's grown from a tiny seed, all these decisions. And that's what we're risking at the moment. That's what we're putting at risk.
And it's not just the people working in the fintech companies. UCL, down the road here, one of the so-called Fab Four top research universities, along with Oxford and Cambridge and Imperial, has said it's all of its all of its EU staff are being poached, headhunted by European institutions saying, why don't you come over to the Europe? You're not welcome in Britain anymore. There's a risk of a brain drain, isn't there, really?
Absolutely. I mean, fintech founders and general tech founders who I speak to have had letters from local authorities in Paris, in Berlin, in Frankfurt saying, hey, do you want to come over? Have a look around. Why not move here? And you know what? When you've got London rent prices, when you've got the risk of Brexit, you know, you can see why that's quite appealing. There is only one company at the moment that's firmly said we're going to move our headquarters. That's TransferWise, which is International Money Transfers. They've said we're going to move our European headquarters. But I'm sure there are more companies waiting in the wings, eyeing up, opening little offices and just planning for 2019.
Thanks very much for coming in, Oliver. Before our final item, a quick reminder that if Brexit-related gloom is beginning to overwhelm you, you can cheer yourself up by listening into our sibling podcast, Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for people who love music, books, film and TV as much as we love the idea of appointing Liam Fox as permanent ambassador to Pyongyang. Boom, boom. Sorry. This week, Michael Hann is in the chair as the smartest pop culture podcast around looks at Nick Broomfield's Whitney Houston documentary, listens to the latest LP from critics' crushes The National, and as Sky Arts start a 10-part history of rock and roll, asks, do we care? That's Big Mouth, pop culture for smart people on SoundCloud and Apple Podcasts, guaranteed to be free from fibs about the benefits of economic self-harm.
Whatever Theresa May says, we on Romaniacs are citizens of the world, so there. We believe the opinions, therefore, of other European citizens regarding Brexit matter as much as our own. Our producer, Andrew Harrison, is in Athens this week, and for the first ever Romaniacs Outside broadcast, he's been talking to Gerard Papasimakopoulos, who is a presenter with Sky Radio in Athens and a musician in a band called The Rattler Proxy. Andrew asked him first about the similarities between Britain's Brexit referendum and the earlier Greek one.
It is interesting that there's a lot of similarities between the Grexit and the Brexit situation, in the sense that it was very, very near the middle. It was very nearly down the middle as far as the two opinions were concerned, like inside the EU or outside the EU. And at the same time, there was a very clear, I think, rhetoric. There was kind of similar. There was a lot of talk about immigration and the horrors of illegal immigration. Obviously, in the case of Brexit, it was overplayed a lot further than it was in Greece. However, there was that aspect of it here in Greece as well. I think what happened was the difference between the two, I think, is that the referendum in our case, which wasn't, you know, used upon as a firing mechanism to jettison Greece from the EU, it was used by the Syriza government to strengthen their position. Of course, it massively backfired, as it turned out, because, you know, Alexis Tsipras, being the clever man that he is, this dazzling array of suits, which were kind of not his size, but anyway, he thought that he was going to get a that the result of the referendum would be for him to say, right, okay, you want to stay in the EU, that gives me the opportunity to go and gain a better deal for us.
Yeah.
I don't think he was expecting so many people to say no, because a lot of people said no, thinking that it meant that we wanted to exit the EU. Whereas Tsipras turned that around into a result that he formed in his own head to suit his political purpose. Yeah. I think there was always the shock because Great Britain were the first country to actually say, right, we are actually leaving. And for a lot of people here in Greece, that's what they wanted to do. That's what they wanted to happen, what they envisioned that the Greek referendum was about, was that if we voted no, it means we're leaving. So I think, again, opinion was split.
Yeah.
To the percentage of the referendum, in the sense that the people that voted yes, let's remain in the EU, or yes, let's agree to these austerity measures, wanted Britain to stay in the EU, and those that voted no were very happy because they took Great Britain's decision as the first hit to the EU underbelly.
Yeah, there is kind of across Europe there is this belief that in certain political quarters that the whole EU thing is starting to crack and fall apart.
What I think makes it interesting in Greece's case is that depending on what side you, what political side you're coming from, in support of Brexit, it made for a very interesting reading, in the sense that if you were coming from the left and supporting Brexit, you were saying, right, and this is the people taking power into their own hands and getting their country back and giving it to the EU. If you were coming from the far right, you were saying, yeah, because they don't want the fucking immigrant scum in their country. And it was a very different analysis of the same result, which is interesting because that's what's happening in Greece. The same results are being interpreted in very different ways because they're coming from a very different political direction.
Do you think it's changed the way Greek people think of the British? Because we always we like to think, the British like to tell ourselves, that we have this reputation for being very calm and very kind of controlled and dependable. And now we're this kind of laughingstock around the world, and people say, what the hell are you doing?
It's not a reality yet. I think that's the main point here. It's like, yes, the UK has chosen to go out, but it's not a reality yet. I mean, the actual reality of the UK being outside the EU hasn't arrived yet.
Yeah.
So in essence, it's like, it's almost like you decide to leave a party, right? But until you leave it and go outside in the driveway and be on your own again and sort of try and walk into your car, you're not actually there yet. You're still inside the party. So it's. I think that's the weird thing about the situation we're in now. The UK have taken the first step, but it isn't a very dramatic step. It's taken the opening step into a whole new world, but it hasn't actually entered that world yet. So I think it's difficult for people outside of the UK to really pay that much attention beyond the first month post-referendum.
Gerard Papasimakopoulos talking there in Athens to our very own Andrew O'Hanrahan-Harrison. Why not? As Eric Morecambe might have said, how much does a Grecian earn? Not as much as before the financial crisis.
And that's just about all for another week. Thanks again to our special guest, Oliver Smith of The Memo. You can read all his stuff at thememo.com. That's The Memo, all as one word. And thanks to Ian and Peter. Don't forget, if you're in London this weekend, you can join the People's March for Europe to demonstrate your rejection of Brexit. It's on Saturday morning, the 9th of September, starting at 11 a.m. near the Hilton Hotel at the bottom of Park Lane. You can also join the march at Trafalgar Square around 12:45 or at 1:30 p.m. in Parliament Square, where there'll be a stage and guest speakers. Some of us will be there, maybe even me, and we'll be reporting back on the march in our next episode. That's the People's March for Europe, starting at 11 a.m. on Saturday morning at the bottom of Park Lane in London. See you there. Before we go, it's Peter's turn to provide a reason to be cheerful.
Maybe nothing to this, but I got a small smidgen of cheer from the Sunday Times story that the government is drawing up plans to offer a Brexit payment of up to £50 billion. I always also saw euros somewhere, but anyway, a large amount.
Maybe basically the same thing.
Exactly. Yes. What's the difference?
Euros will be better, won't it?
Well, indeed, yes. Maybe they should stick to pounds, yes. Now, David Davis instantly rubbished this, but it seems to me that on this, either the government or somebody in the government may be doing something that's not such a bad thing, constantly drip-feeding this idea that maybe we're ready to make a realistic offer on this, and maybe we're getting a little closer to a sum that the EU side would accept, and just sort of dripping it in and wearing down the people who, the John Redwoods of this world, who wouldn't pay, say that they wouldn't pay a penny. I'm just hoping that even if it's not true that they're doing it deliberately and sensibly, at least it will have this effect that, you know, we will start to think we do have to make an agreement on this. If we want any kind of future relationship with the EU, we have to do this, and we have to come up with a realistic figure eventually. So I'm just hoping that this will help in some way.
Fingers crossed. Our sign off this week is in Dutch from Caroline Will.
Tot ziens en blijf strijden.
Thanks for listening and join us again next week. In the meantime, you can tweet us with your views at RomaniacsCast.
Romaniacs was presented by Ros Taylor, Peter Collins and Ian Dunt. The producers were Andrew Harrison and me, Matt Hall. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.